Into the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. This is podcast number 333, and my name is Ben Stone. Now, I want to mention, before we get going today, I want to mention again that there are Bad Quaker t-shirts and stickers that are now available. They've got a really cool design that one of our listeners has drawn for us, and you can get those by going to badquaker.com, look at the right across the top underneath the banner of the old guy, the pictures of the old guys, and on the far right you'll see the button there to take you to the page. So if you hit that button, it'll take you to a page that says click here for t-shirts and stickers. Follow that button, it will take you to our friend Kelly's site over at Survival Gear Bags. And you can buy the t-shirts and stickers there. You help support Kelly and his team, and you help support badquaker.com, and you get a really cool t-shirt in the process, or sticker if you prefer. Also, I wanted to mention that we have been making low bandwidth versions of the podcast. As an experiment today, we're only going to put out the low bandwidth version. Now, we're open to feedback on this. If you have a problem with us only putting out the low bandwidth version, let us know. If you prefer both versions, if you prefer the high bandwidth version, just go to badquaker.com, look underneath the show notes for today, and put in your comments. Lots of folks gave us comments. Well, there's several, I should say. Several folks gave us comments after Monday's podcast. We appreciate that, and the team is looking at all of these comments and the emails that came in and the other methods that people are talking about it, and we want to hear all your opinions before we make any kind of final moves on this. And the last thing I wanted to mention before we start today's podcast is I want to talk again about those secure telephones that I've been talking about. I started talking about these phones, if you recall, back when I very first started doing the series on going beyond civil disobedience. Now, these phones are military-grade encrypted. If you have any Wi-Fi internet network, you can hop on with these phones and call anyone else within the phone network, as long as you know how to contact them. They're not cheap, but they're not super expensive either. They're comparable to a regular cell phone if you look at it in a yearly price range. There's going to be a commercial it's going to be a Freedom Fiends commercial in the middle of today's show. Listen to that. It gives you instructions on how to get a hold of these phones. They're really cool. And, I think there are people, in our movement that really need to have these in their hands. Okay. So now, what I have today is, I had a phone conversation with my friend David Barker from Bitcoin Not Bombs, and I'm gonna let the interview explain everything, but David's got some really exciting stuff going on. So without anything further, here is my interview from yesterday with David Barker. And this is Ben Stone with Bad Quaker, and I'm back once again with David Barker, my good friend. And Davi is going to tell us all about his latest project. Davi was at Porkfest, and they had a contest at Porkfest to see who could come up with the best idea of some type of a business or a project of some kind that could really do something positive. And Davi just had a killer idea and presented it to him. And I'll put a link in today's show notes for a video of that contest. And I'll put in the notes where to advance to see Davi if you don't have time to listen to the entire thing. But either way, get over to the website and watch that. And also, Davi is with me right now. Davi, explain your pitch that you gave at the contest at Porkfest.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me back, Ben. So it was an agorist pitch, and most people think of agorism as black market or gray market activity, and so most people pitched sort of business models. But I argued that that agorism is not fundamentally just commerce. Agorism is anything which seeks to replace coercive systems with voluntary systems. And the long-term goal of agorism is to completely replace all coercive systems with voluntary systems. So I said, we've already proven commerce can happen without the state. And so we need to sort of move forward and begin studying other things that can be done without the state. And the thing that I wanted to do was to begin conducting our own agorist psychological experiments. And the reason for that is that nothing has really changed people's view of authority more than the Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram Experiment, which were both done in the 70s. But they haven't been repeated. And the sort of experiments on obedience and authority that have been done since then are very tame by comparison because of the changes to the ethical guidelines for psychological experiments. So I proposed that we reject the state's ethical guidelines, because what do they know about ethics anyway? And that we should write our own ethical guidelines and begin designing experiments that conform with our ethics to study obedience and authority in a way that is dramatic and can clear, can sort of return the discussion to the mainstream and sort of shock people the way Milgram and Stanford experiments shocked people.
Yeah, and let me just throw in there, I think this is important for a number of reasons, but one thing that sticks out to me is that because all the ethics standards were changed, and because we have government establishing what is and what isn't moral and ethical, which is really a bizarre thought, like you pointed out, those experiments have not been repeated. And since they haven't been repeated, they're not true science. Isn't that right?
Well, the Stanford Prison Experiment has not been repeated at all. The Milgram experiment has been repeated a few times overseas, but not recently. If you look at, I've been looking into some of the recent studies of psychological or studies on authority that have been done, and they're tame by comparison. They're like, sit in a room and tell a person about a time that you felt that you were in a position of authority, or sit in a room and tell a person about a time that you felt you were in a position of subjugation. They're not actually putting them in the position, if that makes sense. And so it's harder to glean relevant data from anything that's happened since then. The other interesting thing is, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this. I'm trying to find the actual ethical guidelines, and the closest thing that I've been able to find is guidelines put out by the APA, which is the American Psychological Association, but that's not a government agency as far as I can tell. It's this weird kind of quasi-government think group, like think tank. So I don't think that this is actually criminal to break these guidelines. I think they're more like guidelines for public funding.
And I don't know if this is the case, this is just a shot in the dark, but I know with a lot of things involving medical doctors and involving dentistry and things like that, there are certain, and the legal profession as well, among the American Bar Association and things, there are, since they essentially have a guild, in psychology, all the psychiatrists are a member of the same thing, and it's very much like a guild. And anybody
That's
who
true.
Violates their rules, they can put sanctions against them all the way up to really nasty fines, that are inflicted by the guild itself. They don't call it a guild, but essentially that's what it is. It's a monopoly, and that monopoly of power, in the long run, it's given to them by governments through, like you're saying, through government funding of different kinds, through university funding and all these other things. These guilds are supported. But oddly enough, for a professional to be shunned from, let's say you're an attorney and the American Bar Association disbars you, well, you're pretty much not an attorney anymore. You know, you're you're practically unemployed.
Yeah, it is. It's a really great term. I think guild is a much more accurate description than a think tank, because it is sort of tied in. It is looped in with sort of legal ramifications, because essentially the state takes their advice, or they're kind of like court advisors, you know. So it's hard to tell exactly where government ends and private association begins.
That, yeah, you get that anytime you have a mercantilist, you know, a distortion of a market like that.
But nonetheless, these guidelines are why public universities don't do this anymore.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we can't. So yeah, I guess step one is that I want to write these ethical guidelines, and I want to consult with, you know, the ethicists and philosophers in the movement about what that might look like, what a legitimate sort of non-aggression principle derived set of guidelines would look like. And then I want to consult with some scientists in the movement and sort of design the experiment so that it isn't just a reality TV show, that it's actually sort of scientifically rigorous and valid.
So really what we're looking at putting together here is a team of people that can communicate that involves maybe some people in the legal field, some people in different areas of the scientific fields, philosophy, ethics, essentially some people who can think. I hate to use the word outside the box, because you know they use that in the corporate world so much, but essentially that's what we're looking at. We're looking at people who can free think and who are grounded in the basic principles that we recognize, like the non-aggression principle or the zero-aggression principle, and produce a set of guidelines so that these experiments can take place, right?
Right. I mean, exactly. Really what it is I need people who can make the distinction in their mind of the difference between legal and moral.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're not the same thing, and I'm much more interested in whether or not I'm much more interested in making sure that the thing is ethical than that the thing is legal.
Let's talk about the Milgram experiment a little bit, and kind of, in case people don't know what that is, kind of give them an idea. Now, this was I can't remember all the details, but essentially the part that I remember, and then you can fill in the gaps that I leave. Essentially, there were volunteers, and the volunteers were going to sit behind a one-way glass, and there was going to be a doctor type person, an official person with, you know, he's official because he's got like a clipboard, and he's wearing a lab coat, and he's probably,
yeah, it's got a lab coat and a name badge.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. And they're looking through a one-way glass, and there's another person in the other room, and they're all hooked to these wires, and they're doing a task. They're at a table or whatever, and they're going to be doing a task. And the thought process is that when they do the task wrong, then there's going to be a mild punishment for them, and then we're going to see if that improves their ability to do the task. And the volunteer in the room with the guy with the lab coat and the name tag, the volunteer will essentially be dialing a dial and pushing a button to give them shocks of electricity.
Right.
The problem is that there's no electricity. It's all fake. The experiment is to see how much pain that a person will inflict upon another person simply because an official person told him to do it. An official person told him that the official will take the responsibility. And why don't you take it from there and explain the rest of the process?
Yeah, so the subject of the experiment is the one doing the electrocuting, the one turning the dial and pushing the button. But they're under the impression that they're an assistant, not that they're a subject. while the person that they think is the subject is the person hooked up to the electrodes. But what they don't know is that that person is a confederate of the scientist, that they are not the subject at all, but an assistant of the scientist. So it was presented to the subject as a experiment on memory. And the question was, can you increase a person's memory by punishing them, right, or something like that. And so they were asked to remember things, and when they misremember things, they're electrocuted. But the learner, the person who's receiving the electricity, begins sort of screaming in pain and complaining about a heart condition, and even saying that they want out, saying that they don't want to participate anymore. And then the subject sort of invariably turns to the scientist and says, hey, you know, maybe we should stop. And the scientist says, the two lines are that achieved compliance were, the experiment requires that you continue, and I will take full responsibility. And those two phrases were chosen because this was specifically intended to sort of learn or try to glean how Nazi Germany was possible. Like, this was done shortly after sort of the atrocities of Nazi Germany were learned about, and people were horrified that human beings would do this, and they wanted to find out how they would do it. So I will take full responsibility was sort of a modification of the I was just following orders argument. And they found that about 60% of people would deliver, would essentially kill a person if the person in the lab coat told them to. And this shocked people. This shocked the scientific community. This shocked the general public, because the estimates before the experiment were done were some that people thought maybe 2% would do it. But in reality, only 2% completely refused.
So this, if this is true, if this really is the case, then we have to rethink guilt when it comes to people in government or whatever following orders and committing atrocities, because if it's actually human nature to just do what you're told, and if people really don't have any internal mechanisms in them to say, you know what, this is wrong and I'm not going to do it, yet you have to kind of look at human nature a little bit different. I'm not sure exactly
well,
how
go ahead. I don't think this speaks to human nature. And this is one of the distinctions that I want to make in my experiment is all of the people involved in both of these experiments are university students, and so you know that they've gone through some degree of public schooling, which is largely about teaching obedience to authority. And so when I design my experiment, I want to make a distinction between subjects who are homeschooled or subjects who are public schooled, or I'm not quite sure exactly how to do that. I might do like subjects who were spanked or subjects who were not spanked, but I want to also include as a variable the subject's history of authority, because one of the things that gave me this idea was from the Stanford Prison Experiment, and if you read Philip Zimbardo's book, The Lucifer Effect, there are two subjects that resist the most. One of them is a devout Christian and one of them is a devout communist. And his reasoning was that, or the hypothesis that Zimbardo presented at the end was, they had a creed, they had an ethic, and they had an identity outside of what authority told them it was. And for that reason, they were able to resist the identity that was being foisted on them. And so, I mean, we're not really speaking to human nature. I mean, not yet. We may be able to drill down to that through some sort of experimentation, but we are dealing with a select group of subjects.
Well, that kind of lends into something that I've talked about at times, about how that human nature has been twisted by authority for generations, you know, especially here in America. Basically from cradle to grave, there's a whole series of things teaching us, you know, a top-down authoritarian style life, where that's not necessarily how humans do in a natural setting. That's not necessarily, you know, it's kind of like raising animals in a zoo, as, or you know, raising pigs, let's say, in a pig factory where the pig, where the circumstances are horrible, and then you say, well, see the, how the pig is behaving, that's pig's nature. No, the pig is adapted to that situation that he's in. That's not necessarily his nature. And that's kind of where we're at with humans in America, at least. We're in a very unnatural setting, so...
Yeah, we're studying humans in captivity.
Yeah, exactly. So the more thinking that's put into this to do it so that we can distinguish between people who are taught their whole life to obey, now what's the result of that, as opposed to people who are taught to think for themselves, and now what's the result?
So that might be the result of some sort of exit survey after they've undergone... the scenario, we can collect sort of personal data from them. We're also talking about doing exit counseling in case any aspect of it is sort of traumatic for anyone. We want to help them work through that.
Let's talk about the prison experiment a little bit, because that one's pretty fascinating too. Now, it's a little fuzzier in my mind. I haven't read about it in a while, but essentially, this argument was used with the
Abu Ghraib, yeah. Philip Zimbardo was brought in as an expert for the defense, and he essentially argued that even though the soldiers were the ones committing torture, the military establishment was the one responsible.
Because essentially they knew what would come of this.
Right. He's arguing that they set up a scenario in which they could reasonably assume that torture would occur, so that they would have plausible deniability and wouldn't need to order anyone to commit torture. And he even speculates with some documentation that they used his research to craft the environment. So that's sort of an issue, too. So the Stanford Prison Experiment, I actually know more about this one than the Milgram Experiment, because I've read a lot of Zimbardo's work. Or a lot more of it, but it was 24 students were sort of selected and screened for mental health. So they are otherwise psychologically healthy young men. And then they are randomly assigned as either prisoner or guard. And they are tasked with conducting a mock prison for 2 weeks in the basement of the Stanford Psychology Building. So the subjects who are assigned as prisoners are given a real arrest with the help of the local police department, and they're booked through the real police department, and then they are dropped off at the prison, the fake prison. Guards are given a uniform and a baton and like those reflective like aviator glasses, and they are told that they are not allowed to physically harm anyone, but that they are to keep a schedule, and that's their only instruction, is to keep a schedule. They completely internalized these identities, and it resulted in things which would be classified as torture within 2 or 3 days. And even Philip Zimbardo himself, because he referred to himself in the scenario as the warden, says that he was taken in by the fake identity of prison warden and allowed the torture to go on longer than was reasonable or ethical. And so he halted the experiment early once he realized that he'd been compromised.
Yeah, and you keep in mind the reaction that they had. Everybody involved knew that it was an experiment. It wasn't like some of the people were actors and some people were being fooled. They all knew this.
No, they all knew. They all signed consent waivers. They all knew that they were free to leave at any time. They brought when it looked like it was getting bad, they brought like a priest or a deacon or something, a minister of some kind, in to sort of counsel the prisoners and see if they wanted to leave, and they didn't want to leave. In addition to the sort of authority psychology going on, there's also a subordinate psychology going on, that these people internalized this role and even felt sort of guilt and shame as if they were like really guilty of something.
This has repercussions in so many directions. I mean, it's obvious, you know, you think about something like Guantanamo Bay and the prison down there, and you think of regular prisons within the U.S. and things like that, and it has so many repercussions in so many directions. But it also, if you think about things like child raising and how to formulate an actual school, how you could bring children together with a teacher, an authority figure, and the same principles would affect how you think about any of those things, because basically a teacher in a normal government school, the teacher-child relationship is very much like a prison guard and a prisoner.
Yeah, and I mean, this is something that sort of strikes me is even those of us who reject authority and reject the legitimacy of these rules and willfully break them, there is this like gut reaction of shame when you're caught, which is so strange. Because it's really, like, it's deeply ingrained in people. I don't know if you have this experience, but I've had this experience where, I didn't wear a seatbelt. It's a legal requirement to wear a seatbelt, but I don't wear it. I actually think that it makes you a more dangerous driver, and there's some statistics to back up that position. And so for a long time, I just didn't wear a seatbelt. And then when I get pulled over and they want to give me a ticket, I still have this weird, like, oh, you caught me feeling. Even though I don't believe in the legitimacy of the uniform of the guy who caught me, that's like this weird gut reaction. And I think that's part of the subordinate identity.
It would really be interesting, and I hope this works out so that we can follow through on all this and find out something about it, because it would be really interesting to me to find out how much of that is learned behavior and how much of it is natural, just embedded into our beings. I tend to think that it's learned behavior. I hope that that's what we find out.
I think that it is. That's my hypothesis. The experiment that I'm hoping to design is about police brutality. And so there will be definitely an opportunity to pull the subjects about their personal experience with police officers so that we can correlate that. Like whether or not they were part of a DARE program or whether or not they've ever been arrested, or we'll have a body of data of their history with law enforcement or with authority to compare to the statistics of the way people responded and reacted.
Now, we haven't actually worked out the details of how this experiment will take place, but you can kind of give us an idea of what you've thought of so far. I know we want to maybe have... Perhaps one of the scenarios could be the subject watching an event through a video camera, or possibly even the subject being on one side of a door while the event is supposedly taking place on the other side of the door, and all the subject has to do is open the door to stop the experiment. Explain.
So, yeah.
Go ahead.
This is sort of the rough draft of the design, and I owe some credit to Stephanie Murphy for this device, because there was some concern that if you had an instance of police brutality and you want to get a subject to intervene, that you're putting your Confederate officer in danger because you're asking the subject to physically intervene in a physical altercation. And so she came up with this device that protects everybody from any physical harm. And essentially what it would be is probably the scientist is going to, like, walk the subject down a hallway and through a door. And above that door, there's going to be a surveillance camera. So the subject sees the surveillance camera when they walk into the lobby. In the lobby, they will see a video feed of that hallway. And so they'll hopefully associate the camera with the video screen. Then at some point, like, there's some interaction with the scientist, sort of wait here, basically. And then someone else, like a previous subject, will sort of walk from inside this office area through the lobby and out the hallway. And then in the camera, you'll see a video of that person being assaulted by a police officer. Now, the video will be pre-recorded, so this won't really be going on in the hallway. That way, every subject receives the same performance, and there's no disparity in the performance of the actors. But by having the video screen in the lobby and the sound from the hallway, you create the illusion that this incident is occurring right on the other side of this door in the hallway that the subject was just in. And so the question is, how long will they allow this instance of police brutality to escalate before they open the door? And so opening the door constitutes intervention. It doesn't matter why they were doing it. We can ask them those questions after the fact. Maybe they were going to yell. Maybe they were going to record with their phone. Maybe they imagined that they were going to physically intervene. But we can ask them that after we know that they would have entered the scene. And that way nobody's ever in any physical danger.
Yeah, because you never know if you really had them acting it out live, you never know if somebody's just going to whip open the door and start, you know, beating the crap out of the cop character, and that's something we would want to avoid.
Right.
Davi, let's break here for a moment, and I'll save this file, and we can hear from our sponsors, and then we'll come back in a very short time with more with Davi Barker.
Need to talk to people in a secure manner? Liberty Private Network sells phones that will work over any good internet connection and give you military-grade encryption for calls that cannot be tapped. Great for lawyers and clients, business people with trade secrets, or just ordinary folk who don't want their love talk spied on by some scumbag from the central scrutinizer. Call 516-TLK-SAFE on your non-secure phone and tell them the Freedom Fiends sent you. That's 516-TLK-SAFE.
Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting amagimetals.com. That's AmagiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you. And we're back with Davi Barker. And Davi, I failed to mention, is also known as the Muslim agorist. Davi, before we get back to talking about the your latest project, these experiments, let's talk a little bit about a really cool thing that you've got going on with shiny badges. Now, you've made quite a few different things, because Davi is an artist, for the listeners that don't know. On top of everything else, Davi is a true Renaissance man. I mean, he's a man of many talents. He's a thinker. He's a philosopher. What's your religious position? Is there any title that you have?
I just use Muslim. Okay. You mean like, am I an imam or a sheikh or something?
No. Right. I was going to ask. That was the direction.
You could say that I'm a student, but in Arabic the word is talib, and that's really sort of a no-no in the American nomenclature.
But in addition to all that, Davi is also an artist, and you have these really cool badges that are based on the Keene, New Hampshire Police Department, right?
Yeah, so... Yeah, shinybadges.com is mostly lapel pins. If you go, there's a lot of like liberty-themed and voluntarist lapel pins and some Bitcoin designs as well. But the latest one is sort of a fundraiser for copblock.org, and it's a full-sized metallic police badge, and it's from a manufacturer that makes police badges, so it is as authentic as it gets as far as being a mimic. And it's based on the Keene police badge, and instead of the city seal in the center, there's the copblock.org logo, and instead of the normal sort of banners, say like Keene Police or Protect and Serve or something like that, it says shiny badges don't grant extra rights. And they're all individually numbered, so people have sort of requested numbers that are significant to them. I think we're up to we're in the 200s now. And it's just been a blast all the way around. I launched them at Porkfest this year with the first 100 of them and raised a bunch of money for Copblock, and now Pete and I are working together to sell them on our websites, and you know, we'll see where it goes. It seems like they've been really popular.
They were really the cool thing to have at Porkfest 10. They and a lot of people were showing off. They were very proud, and they were showing off their badges. And there was a certain scramble for key numbers. The 100, who ended up getting the number 100?
Number 100. No, I'm not sure.
But there were certain scrambles for specific numbers, and like 66 for Route 66, and there were other numbers as well.
Yeah.
But eventually...
I know Ademo got 187. He was very keen on getting that, which is police code for officer down. what else? Well, anyway, the big one is 420. So we've manufactured up to 420, and we're planning on auctioning off the 420 badge as a fundraiser for Rich Paul.
And that was the direction I was taking that. I just kind of wandered off on talking about Porkfest. But, yeah, so whoever ends up with the 420 badge, that's going to be, for some people, that's a pretty important thing.
Yeah.
I know for neither you.
The other thing is numbers are significant to people for strange reasons. Like, we had one guy wanted, I don't remember even what the number was, it was 44 or something, and it was because it was his jersey number, that he was on a basketball team, and that was his jersey number. And then I got an email from a guy who said that he used to be a police officer, and then he sort of left the force as a sort of conscientious objector after discovering liberty, and now he wanted a cop block badge with his old cop number on it, and so he requested that number. And everybody has, there's no way to predict what numbers are significant to what people.
Let's go back to the experiment. And we were talking about the Sanford prison experiment. One of the things that really stands out as you read that story of how that took place is that the guy who was playing the warden, the professor that was actually doing the experiment, he scared himself. He scared his family, and he scared himself. And before he realized that, wow, this thing is really messed up, and I have to shut this down. Somebody's going to get killed or whatever.
Well, he scared his girlfriend, is what happened. He brought his girlfriend to see what he was working on because he had been sort of mysterious about it, and he sort of like gave her a tour of the prison and talked about how proud he was of the project and how much relevant data they were getting. And she was horrified and threatened to leave him because she thought he was a monster. And that's what sort of shocked him awake into seeing what sort of he'd allowed to happen.
And the strange part in that is that he probably would have had the same reaction had he walked into it in the middle and seen it. But because it was happening around him in real time, he didn't realize what he was in the middle of until somebody from the outside pointed it out to him.
Yeah, it's that kind of boiling frog effect.
That's something that was pointed out about the Abu Ghraib. With a B on the end?
Yeah, it's a grave with a B.
Okay. Anyway, with that situation, you know, it's been said by some of them that they'd never even really thought about what they were doing until it was pointed out later, and then they went back and looked at it and said, wow, I can't believe we were doing that, you know?
Yeah. The guards said the same thing. When they were interviewed after the experiment was over, they were shocked by their own behavior.
Yeah, it just didn't dawn on them what they were doing as they were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that taken into a situation where you think about, you know, the Nazis and the procedure that went on there, or you think about current day prisons that are where things are happening, or you think about the authority that cops have. There's a situation that happened sometime back, I think maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago in Florida, where a man who was actually ill, he had mental problems, was arrested. He'd taken himself off of his medication, and he had made some kind of a fuss. And so the cops arrested him, took him in, had him handcuffed in a chair, and repeatedly sprayed him in the face with mace over and over, and he had a mask on because they had decided that he was a spitter, and the mask would hold that mace right in against his face, and he's sitting right in the middle of a hallway. There's cameras on him. There are people walking past him. There's a desk off to the side where a person is manning it all the time. And they continued to torture him like that until they eventually killed him. And they killed him right there in front of everybody, And nobody noticed because it was just, it's just a guy there. He's just a prisoner and he's violent. So we spray him every now and then. And it never dawned on them what they were doing, if they had switched a cop to that situation, the cop would have reacted just like the guy who was handcuffed to the chair. Because he's trying to get away, he tries to cooperate for a little while, that doesn't work, he tries fighting back, that doesn't work, he tries submitting, that doesn't work. You know,
he's trying to keep himself alive, that's what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. And anybody else would have reacted exactly the same way. But because of the authoritative situation, they literally tortured the man to death. And the whole time his wife was calling on the phone trying to get through, hey, he needs his medication, he's not in his right mind, I need to help him, please give me some information, and they wouldn't tell her anything.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like anytime you mix a police encounter with a medical issue, it's all kinds of problems. I mean, there's so many stories about them, like, killing epileptics because they think that the person's not complying because they're having a seizure, you know, and...
Part of this can be, you can make an excuse of education, and you can carry that excuse so far, but I don't know how you can justify so many incidences by just saying, well, the cop was not educated, he just didn't know.
He's in a position that incentivizes that. That's the whole point. Is any psychologically healthy person put in a position of prison guard will eventually behave like a prison guard.
Yeah, exactly. I have to mention this just because there was a local incident that happened. The current trend of cops killing people's pets, their kittens, their dogs, and this kind of thing, is a disturbing trend that seems to be getting worse and worse. There was a situation here locally in Ohio where some kid had done some stupid thing. It was a very minor situation, and a cop starts chasing him on foot, calls for backup. You know, those people are like sharks. They come from every direction, and they can't wait for something like that to happen. And so the cops swarm into this neighborhood, and one of the cops runs into a backyard because he thought maybe that the kid had run into that backyard. And there's a family dog there that is a very large, white, a husky mix, which huskies are big and can be scary, and they kind of look like wolves. But they're big, dumb playthings. They're not, huskies don't have any particular tendency towards violence. But when a stranger comes running into the backyard of a husky, he's going to run out and see what's going on. And the cop took that as an attack and, of course, shot the dog. And it hit the news right away. Local police has to kill a wolf to protect himself. And it's not a wolf, it's a husky, you know. But they have to twist it. They have to spin it and try to protect the cop at all times in these situations.
Right.
I know that's a kind of a leap, kind of a stretch from our discussion. But it's this authority figure that how dare this dog try to guard his own yard? Doesn't he know I have a badge?
Right. I mean, but dogs don't. Dogs have no clue whatsoever. Although I've heard that, like, postmen have problems with dogs because dogs have some sort of feeling about uniforms. Have you ever heard this before?
I know it's an old standard Hollywood thing that dogs hate postmen. But I don't know if they've actually done any experimentation as far as the uniform goes.
Well, one way or the other. I mean, it's a stranger in their yard. Dogs are, their purpose is to be a guard dog half the time. So, yeah. So I wanted to pick your brain if you had any thoughts on whether or not it was unethical to traumatize a person. That if asking someone or causing someone to witness an instance of police brutality that they might find dramatic, was it, or traumatic, might itself be unethical. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it's kind of hard to draw a solid line because some people are quite tender and others are not. For me, you know, I was in a heavy rescue squad for a good period of time, and I saw some pretty rough things. And it doesn't affect me, I don't think, in the way that it would affect somebody else to see something like that. And then again, other people that I know they don't have to see very much at all, and it really bothers them for a long period of time. So, yeah, it might be a fuzzy area. It might be necessary to have some kind of screening process to, if we could find out ahead of time who is more susceptible from that kind of trauma and who is less susceptible, and maybe avoid, it's hard for me to take the mindset of somebody, I guess this is what I'm trying to say, it's hard for me to take the mindset of somebody who might be more on the delicate side, because I honestly think I have a flaw in my brain, because when I see things that are really, really bad, I kind of turn off my emotion and click into a mechanical reaction to it. Whether that's, you know, like I use this as an example quite a few times. Several times I've had people draw guns on me and either shoot me or shoot at me or intend to shoot me. And my reaction is generally to charge right at them as fast and hard as possible and just beat the crap out of them. I mean, and that's not necessarily a logical response to such a situation. But, and then, you know, once the situation is in control, I'm not angry. I'm not wild or crazy or anything, but at that moment, if you were like filming me or something, you would think, well, he's crazy. Who charges right at a gun like that when the person's trying to kill him? So I'm not sure that I think there's a flaw in my brain that keeps me from reacting in a normal way to an emergency situation. So it's hard for me to sympathize for somebody who would be traumatized by that. Is that have I thoroughly given an excuse as to why not to give an answer?
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, you're definitely kind of a special case because, I mean, you used to be a biker, and you've had, I'm sure, encounters with even with law enforcement where it was, you've sort of overcome that fear, I'll bet, right?
Yeah.
But the answer to who would be delicate or who would be traumatized is people with a history. People who, you know, who had been hit by their parents or hit by their spouses or hit by police officers or anybody for whom it triggers sort of that fight or flight back of the brain kind of mechanism for them, you know?
Yeah. If you could have some kind of a screening process to remove, and I don't even know if you'd want to remove all of the people that would say yes to a question like, you know, have you ever been struck by a cop or have you ever been abused by your parents or, you know, because even then I think some people are going to be able to react to a situation like that. I think of my two daughters, for an example. The older of the two has had some pretty rough situations that she's had to deal with and live through, and it toughened her. And I think if she faced another rough situation today, she would tough her way through it. She wouldn't fold. She wasn't broken, if you can put it that way. Her spirit wasn't broken. The younger of my two daughters has never really faced any type of hard trauma in her life. And so I don't know if she would react to it, you know, with fight, flight, or panic. I don't know. Since she's never been tested, you know.
Yeah, it's also like screening them out. Also, like, I wouldn't necessarily want to do that because I'm interested in that data. So, like, I would screen out children for sure.
Right. Right.
But to get a representative statistic of a general population, it seems like you would want to just include a general population.
Yeah, you'd want to screen out anybody with a heart problem. Or anybody with known mental issues. I'm not sure exactly how you would tactfully screen a person who has had some type of mental problems.
Yeah, the other thing is the more questions you ask ahead of time, the more you bias the data.
That's true.
So, like, I have this idea of a way of getting the sort of informed consent you want to have before the thing happens. And the idea was that when they come and they sit in the lobby, before before the actual incident has occurred, there would be a scientist who sort of gives them a clipboard and says, I need you to fill this out and I'll be right back, right? And then he goes off into the office. And that clipboard would be a sort of general questionnaire of like, here's what you're participating in, do you consent, right?
Yeah.
And it would have to be vague enough, but it would have to include like, are you willing to see something traumatic? Like as if you're watching like, as if maybe they would think they were going to watch like a violent movie trailer or something, you know? Or I don't know.
You know, you could actually, here's a thought. You could have something set up like a, let's say they're in the room, and there's a TV in the room, and there's what is obviously a DVD player or, you know, some kind of setup, maybe even a computer or whatever, but, the indication is they're gonna watch something on this TV and then give their feedback as to what they see. And what they see, may be shocking or whatever. And so that's separate from what actually shows in a monitor of the other room that we've already described.
Well, yeah, the presumption would be that whatever, that the second television or the whatever, the whatever might be part of the sort of fake experiment would be in the room next door. That way, like, once you had their signature of whatever sort of release that you wanted them to sign, then the scientist sort of takes that into the other room and, like, walks what is presented as the previous subject out. And that previous subject would be the one who's attacked.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That would work.
So the waiting area is essentially, it's presented as just a waiting area. And by having a subject come from deeper inside, they're sort of led to believe that the rest of the experiment is occurring in the next room over. And that's where they're like signed state. Like, so essentially you're in the waiting area. I need you to fill it sort of like in a hospital. I need you to fill out this questionnaire and this whatever. And then I'm going to take that inside and then I'm going to bring you inside to the experiment. And what they don't realize is that the experiment is happening right there in the lobby.
What about the possibility of having more than one person, let's say the room that they're in, there's already two more potential subjects in the room, but they're actors as well. And they're all filling out, they all have a clipboard, they're all filling out the same thing, and you set them there. And so I'm thinking you might want to do this separately to see what the reaction of a person when they're by themselves observing this thing and see what their reaction is. And then put them in where there's, say, two other witnesses, one of which says, oh, man, we've got to do something. And the other person says, you know, no, it's not our business. Fill out your form or whatever.
And then you get into the group dynamic. That's a different kind of experiment. Like, there were experiments where, like, 10 people are lined up and asked the same simple question, and the answer is obvious. Like, it's which one of these lines is longer than the other one. And only the 10th person is a subject. The 9 people are Confederates that all intentionally give the wrong answer. And then the subject sort of like gets confused and gives the wrong answer. And it's sort of it's a test in conformity. And, so then you kind of get into how many people does it take to defect before a person defects.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This might not be the best scenario to test that. But it would probably be interesting to see, like, if they were all subjects, because I'm worried that whatever performance was given by the other people in the room would bias everything.
Yeah, and that kind of goes with what Stephanie was saying too, that you're dependent upon a spontaneous performance that might or might not work. So
right.
Yeah, so if you were going to do something with multiple subjects, they would all need to be true subjects, not actors.
Yeah, and that does give you a sort of group dynamic. Like, it's sort of there. I mean, I don't think this was an experiment. I think this is statistical research in crime data. But they've shown that the larger the pool of people who can potentially call in a crime, like a rape, the less likely anyone will do it. So if a person thinks that there's only one or two people who are witnesses to a crime, one of them is likely to call. But if it's happening in an apartment building, everybody sort of assumes that someone else will call it in, and then nobody does.
Hmm.
So you could probably, if you redid the experiment multiple times with larger and smaller groups of people in the lobby, you may find that one person doesn't intervene because they feel physically overwhelmed by an officer, but three people might intervene, but 10 people won't intervene, you know, something like that.
Right, right. And that could be a factor. The individual person in there might feel like, you know, if I do open the door and intervene, I'm subject to getting tased or beat or whatever as well. Possibly in addition to just opening the door as a mechanism of stopping the subject, maybe even pulling out a camera and starting to videotape the monitor that's showing what's happening in there. That could be a response that would, at least the person is witnessing it, saying, oh, somebody has to know about this. I'm not going to let them get away with it.
Yeah, people have brought that up. I definitely think that is that's a possible reaction that someone would have. And I think that that's relevant data. But I don't think that that would halt the experiment.
Right.
Like, that would become a statistic after the fact. Like, X number of people recorded up to this point, and you know, that just sort of becomes part of the analysis. But I would want them to sort of continue, because they're by stopping the experiment there, you haven't prevented any physical threat. They haven't made any physical intervention, so there's no reason not to continue to run the video.
Right.
The other thing that people brought up, and I think this is definitely something we're going to do, is run the experiment with separate groups of people, where one is an assault by an officer and one is the exact same scene, scripted the same way, by somebody in street clothes, so that you have a sense of how much the badge changes a person's willingness to intervene.
Yeah, definitely. That would definitely be of value. With exactly the same, I think you said this, but I just want to emphasize it, with exactly the same activity taking place.
Right. So it would need to look like an assault. It would need to be the kind of behavior that could be done by either a civilian or an officer, as opposed to, like, putting their hands behind their back and putting them in handcuffs and things like that. Like, because that's clearly police behavior. And even if you see a civilian doing that, you might assume that they're an officer, right?
Yeah.
So it would need to appear like just an assault. What happens if a police officer just assaults someone?
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Well, let's give a recruiting pitch to any of the listeners that, you know, anybody in the legal field, anybody in psychology, psychiatry, somebody in, you know, any of the scientific fields that that thinks that this is the kind of thing that they'd like to get, maybe get involved with, or at least have, you know, some input, even if it's just to say, well, I think this or I think that. What's the best way for folks to interact in this situation?
You can contact me directly at davi@bitcoinnotbombs.com. That's D-A-V-I at bitcoinnotbombs.com. We're also going to be essentially running this through. I'm going to be using Bitcoin Not Bombs as the sort of spearhead organization for organizing stuff. And yeah, you know, it's any level of involvement. I need to be consulting with scientists and ethicists. We're going to probably need people involved in some sort of a production team eventually, or fundraisers or sponsors or donors or anything.
Videography, so, maybe even construction. I mean, somebody that can furnish chairs. There's all kinds of ways that people can help with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be presenting, Drew Phillips and I are going to be presenting at Libertopia next month. And so we're sort of going to hash this out into sort of a presentation and present it to a larger audience, because Porkfest is a pretty small audience. And yeah, hopefully we just start putting a team together who's sort of willing to do the work with me, you know?
Yeah, Libertopia is a lot more. It's my assumption, I've never been to it, but it's a lot more mainstream in the movement, and there's a lot of times some pretty big name people there and fairly good sized crowds, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Have you been to Libertopia before?
No, I've never been before.
Oh.
I've been to Liberty Forum, which I understand is similar, but I think Libertopia is larger.
Yeah, that's my understanding, yeah. Well, Davi, thanks a lot for coming on the show with me. And, you know, you and I are going to continue to talk about this because I definitely want to do anything I can to help. And feel free to contact me anytime. You know, that's always the case with anything. But I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I hope you get all the kind of backing to do this because I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, thanks. I do too. You know, I've been sort of overwhelmed since having the idea with the size of it. It's pretty much the biggest and most important thing I think I've done in the liberty movement so far. And so I'm committed to doing it right, even if it takes like longer than I would like, you know?
Well, I really appreciate your work on this, and I know you know, it's a long, hard work ahead, and I don't envy you in that sense. I'm far too lazy of a person to envy that much work, but I really do appreciate your service in it, and man, I wish you the best in it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Davi. And folks, be sure, if you can help this in any way, financially or through involvement or whatever, get a hold of Davi over there at Bitcoins Not Bomb. Bitcoin in the singular sense.
In the singular, yeah.
Not bombs in the plural sense. So Bitcoin Not Bombs, and I'll have links in today's show notes for that. And get involved. I mean, you know, this might be, if you've never done anything in the Liberty Movement, this might just be perfect for you. So thanks a lot, Davi. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
And that was the interview with Davi Barker. Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.